Okay, Boker Tov, good morning. Welcome, everybody. Thank you again for all the arrangements, the coffee and the attendance, and especially on such a beautiful day. I don't know what happened to the winter, but I said that a month ago, and it's still, I don't know, maybe we're going to get lucky. Baruch Hashem. I want to continue the theme. The theme of this, I'm calling it a semester, the talks we're doing, is I said something old, something new. So last time we spoke about something very new, the whole question, good morning, the question of advertising and sort of the origins and some of the principles of advertising that we found in very traditional sources, and I hope that was interesting. Here we're doing something old, but really something quite new, because there's so much about the Purim holiday that we, how do I describe this? That there are questions we're afraid to ask. I was reading an article this week by Shlomo Goren. So he asked the question I've had for years. How did they know who the Amalekites were? 75,000 killed throughout the empire. Did the Amalekites walk around saying with a t-shirt saying, hello, I'm Amalek? You know, how did you know? How? I mean, that's a question which I'm not even going to deal with today, but it's just something to think about. Even in Shushan, where it says that Esther said the first day they killed, I think, 500, or was it 300 and 500, I forget which way around it is. And even there, why did Esther delay it for another day in Shushan that they had to go and kill another 300 on the next day? Why not get the whole thing done on one day? Everybody celebrates Purim on the 14th of Adar, and you don't have this situation like you have in certain places in Yerushalayim, where some people keep one day and some people keep another day. It's crazy. I lived in a neighborhood in Yerushalayim where half the community kept the 14th because it was just a bit away from Jerusalem and the Seretz Zion, and a whole bunch of people kept the 15th. And that, to me, is really a strange holiday, you know, where half the people are doing it, half the people aren't doing it. So go figure. It's all questions on the story of Megillah, which really we, you know, it's things that we're almost feel it's sacrilegious to ask. And the ultimate question, which I'm actually dealing with on Wednesday morning, not this week, probably 2 weeks' time, is the question of Esther and Ahasuerus. I just saw the Oscar brought out this wonderful introduction to the Talmud, fabulous book, it's in the library, and they mentioned in passing the tradition of the oral law, and they talk about Esther and Ahasuerus and their son, and no explanation whatsoever. And I'm sure if anybody reads that, will say, what are you talking about, Esther and Ahasuerus and their son? Turns out that, you read the story at the end, Esther did not go back to Mordechai and, you know, go back to Meir Shearim and live a nice kosher life. She stayed with Ahasuerus, for goodness sake. And not only that, but they had a child. And all of that element of the story of Purim is something that I think we're very uncomfortable with. The rabbis are prepared to talk about it. There's a lot of Gemara about it. But it's a very, very delicate situation. And I always like to mention the introduction of Benny Lau. Benny Lau is one of the wonderful teachers in Israel at the moment, lives in Emek Rufaim, and he had his shul, just retired from his shul, the Ramban Shul, which I hope many of you will visit if you haven't visited already. It's really a wonderful community there. And he says he has a very strange relationship with Purim. His relationship started off as a kid, dressing up and very excited. You know, my granddaughter's already, you know, the costumes, they've told me yesterday, their theme this year, it's all very wonderful and great. As you get a bit older, and then, of course, you become, for the guys, you go to yeshiva, and all of a sudden, Purim becomes, you know, Chag HaShikurim, as opposed to Chag HaPurim, and it's a question of what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to. You know, we all did it, and my wife will never let me forget it, because she knows some of the stories and all the rest of it, and it's one of those things you do. As you get a bit older, Rav Lau says, he became Rav of Kibbutz, and in the Kibbutz, he used to do what's called a Nesher, which is like an evening program, and they had a Purim Shmiel, and it was very nice. He says he got to the age of 40, and at the age of 40, he suddenly woke up and said, wait a minute, this is a holiday with a lot of problems. How do I understand the whole story? How do I understand what was going on? How do I make head or tail of the whole event? And that's, he says, when he went to Bar Ilan, he did his PhD, and he got into the history. And his commentary on the history is really phenomenal, and you know, I recommend it online, and I've spoken about it, and it's certainly worth hearing. I can't go over it now. But basically, Purim becomes a holiday where your relationship to the holiday does change over the course of years. And so I'm certainly at the stage that Rav Lau was at when I'm asking these questions, because you've got to ask these questions. And the big question today, in fact, two questions. Question number one, I'm going to ask who wrote the Megillah, right? Which may seem an obvious question, but believe it or not, it's not so obvious at all. And as a follow-up to that question, we're going to deal with this piece which I've handed out, which you can take away. In the middle, there is a very beautiful article from Arot Sheva, Shira Smiles. Great name. Right? I don't know if any of you know her. She teaches in LA. She's a wonderful teacher and really a great article, which I'll just praise some of the points, but this is worth taking away. It's a nice article to read on the whole subject that we're talking about this morning. Right, without question, the main question of what Purim will be like in the future, which is really the point of this shiur, I'm going to start off by talking about who wrote the Megillah. So you've got the Megillahs open in front of you. You have the book, the art scroll. It's on page 1260. If you open up to page 1260 at the top of the page, verse 20, right? I hope you follow this. I didn't print it out on the paper because I thought you'd have the books here. It's nicer to use the Sefer. 1260. And it's at the top of the page, verse 20. Who wrote the Megillah? Okay, I mean, again, if we had a show of hands, I think most of you would say Mordechai and Esther. But even that is not quite true. Look at verse 20 of chapter 9, right? It's verse 20 of chapter 9. It may actually be 1261, yeah. Right at the top there. Vayichtov, verse 20. Vayichtov Mordechai. It says Mordechai wrote et ha-devarim ha-eile, these words. Vayishlach Sefarim, no mention of Esther at all. It's all Mordechai, right? And he sends Sefarim, the books, El Kol Yudim, meaning the story of the Megillah, to all the Jews, Asher B'chol Midot Melech Hashverosh, all the places of the 127 countries, verse 21, L'kayem Aleim Liot Osim, to fulfill Arba Asar, the 14th Chodesh Adar, of the month of Adar. Ve'diyom Chamishasa Bo B'chol Shana V'shana. And the 15th also every year. Right? So according to that verse, verse 20, who wrote the Megillah? It says Mordechai. Period. Go a bit further down and look at verse 20. Just a second. Where are we? Oh, sorry, verse 29. Verse 29 says, Vatichtov, and she wrote, right, Loshen Nekeva, Esther Hamalka Bat Avichail, U Mordechai Yudi, et Kol HaToker, Lekayem et Igeret HaPurim HaZot HaSheinit. So who's writing the Megillah at this point?
Esther.
Esther and Mordechai. So wait a minute, what's going on? Firstly, it was Mordechai writing the story without Esther. There's no mention of Esther there. Then in verse 29, Vayichtov Esther Malka, I'm stressing the singular there, feminine, meaning that she wrote it in the sense she was the instigator more than Mordechai. And they wrote it called Tokef L'Kayem Et Geret HaPurim HaZot HaSheinit. They sent out a second version, a second Megillah, which went right round the 127 countries. Vayishlach Sefarim, verse 30. And he sent the Sfarim, all of the texts, the Kol Yudim, Sheva Esumei Medina, to the 127 countries. So wait a second, make up your mind. Was it Mordechai who wrote it? Was it Esther and Mordechai wrote it together? And here comes the bombshell. I didn't produce this in front of you, but I'll just read to you the Gemara in Baba Batra, where the Gemara says, who are the authors of the books of the Bible? Very interesting Gemara on page 15. And the Gemara says, oh, so typical Gemara. Just let me read it to you. It says, Yechezkel Shneimasa, Daniel, Megillat, it's talking about the authors of the books of the Bible. So it says, Anshei Knesset Agdola, the men of the Great Assembly, beginning of the Second Temple period. Who wrote, what did they write? Katvu, they wrote, Yechezkel, the book of Ezekiel, Shneimasa, they wrote the 12 minor prophets, they wrote them down, Daniel, U Megillat Esther, and they wrote the book of Esther. So as they say in good, what's the word, you know, TV shows, make up your mind. Make up your mind. Who's writing this book? It starts off Mordechai, it then becomes Mordechai and Esther, and then men of the Great Assembly. What is going on? It's so odd. And the Gemara doesn't make any mention in this statement of what we know from the Megillah, that it was Mordechai and then Mordechai and Esther, the Gemara says, no, obviously the men of the great assembly. What is happening here? It's very, very challenging. Who's writing this book? And the book becomes such a, widely accepted throughout the Jewish world, that the book of Esther, you know, the Megillat Esther, and many people, this is one of their treasured possessions that they have, you know, and all these sort of things. It's very odd.
Why does it use the Vatichtov Esther?
Mordechai,
then it should have said Vayichtavu.
Correct. The answer is because she was pushing it. I'll tell you the story.
She was the wife behind the man.
But it's more than that. Listen to this. And this is where I have to touch a little bit on what Rav Lau says. There is a very strong suggestion, and I'm not going to go into this in any great detail, but I've been talking about this for months, and the other shiurim I've been giving, that Mordechai and Esther started off as being not necessarily the great religious figures that we consider them to be. It could very well be that at the beginning of the whole story, they were both very secular. The whole community was secular. The community had assimilated. They went to the, you know, we know all the stories. They went to the Suda. What were they eating at the Suda? It wasn't from Milma, I can assure you. What they were eating was definitely food which they should not have been eating. Now, was Mordechai standing there going, no, no, no? Or was he the Mashgiach? There's no suggestion of that. Could be that Mordechai was there. Who knows? Maybe he didn't eat anything, but he was there. The whole concept at the beginning of the Megillah, which is really disturbing, but may very well be the case, is that Mordechai and Esther are what we would call leaders in the federations today, leaders in APAC, you know, Jews who may not necessarily be religiously committed, but are very Jewishly committed. And what Esther does at the beginning with Mordechai could very well be that they, because of their high position, Mordechai was a general in the army, according to the Midrashic text, and he knew Haman from there, and all the stories that go into the whole background of that. Turns out that Mordechai and Esther become more connected to the Jewish community as the time goes on, but they are nevertheless not the figures that we consider them to be. Mordechai is not the quintessential Rosh Yeshiva, and Esther is not the quintessential, you know, Esther Malka that we all have the image of. It could be that as the story goes on, their Jewish identity grows, for sure. But are they, in the end, the sort of people that we would expect them to be, you know, sort of dressed and coming from a world that we expect them to come from? Not necessarily, even by the end. And what Rav Lau wants to suggest, and this, I think, fits into this story, is that, and it says at the end, when Mordechai, when the whole thing was over, this famous thing, which is a warning to all people working for shuls, Matsui Lerov Echad. Right? In the end, he saved all their tuchsis, pardon the expression, and he's only acceptable Lerov to the majority. They had a vote in the committee. Do we like Mordechai or don't we like Mordechai? Majority said we do, the minority said we don't. Go figure. It's unbelievable. And that's what it says at the end of the Megillah. So this is what happened. Nothing new. Nothing changes in the Jewish world. But what is so interesting, and this is really fascinating, is the suggestion, it could be, that Esther had a fight. Esther's fight was to get Purim recognized as a holiday. So what did Esther do? You know, you've got to get Purim recognized. Who do you go to? You go to the rabbis with the beards. You have to go to the serious gentleman. So she went to the rabbi. And she said to them, remember, she's Queen Esther. She's married to Ahasuerus. She's staying with him. She said, I want to write down the story of the Megillah. I want you to write it down. Right? So they turned around and said to her, no, look. And this is a Gemara in Megillah, page 7. Again, I'm not going to quote all the Gemaras, but you can look this up. It's very easy. Page 7 at the beginning. And they have a big fight. The rabbi said, we don't want it. So Esther said, why not? So they said, because, you know, we've got enough Torahs. We want to write down this story. More anti-Semitism. People will read it and start reading about the Jews controlling the 127 countries in the world. You know, we know this story. We know where this comes from. And it's a problem. And the rabbis refused. And Esther said, but you've got to write it down. And she made a good argument. She said, if you don't write it down, they're going to write down their version of the events, which makes Esther and Mordechai seem the bad guys, right? And bad news. It's not going to be authentic. It's going to be false. So therefore, we need to have our version as we experienced it, as we had it. Eventually, the rabbis agree. But one gets the pressure from that Gemara with great reluctance. So what happens, I think, this is what's going on in the Megillah. Initially, sending the letters around the world, and it's being written down, Mordechai, the first response of what happened is to write to every community in the world, you've got to celebrate this incredible miracle, a Purim holiday to be celebrated. As we know, there are many communities around the world that had their own private Purim holidays. Right? In Prague, there are many examples of, in various other places. So there is this tradition. The problem is, that's a one-off. So Mordechai wrote the Sforim, and he sent it out for the first year after these events took place. And it was very nice, received by everybody, good excuse for another party. But, finished. What's going to happen in year two? And Esther said to Mordechai, and this is the next comment over here, but it's called Igeret HaShenit. It says in verse 29, the second letter, Mordechai and Esther realized, certainly Esther wanted the holiday to be permanent. You can't just have a one-off celebration. This was something that affected every Jew in the known world at the time. So Esther says, and that's why it's by Tichtov, she was the inspiration for this. She says in verse 29, we've got to write it down again. And we've got to send it out to all of the Jewish community all over again. Not only you, Mordechai, but I'm going to add my shtempel, the queen of Persia, adds her stamp to the thing. And then everybody will receive this and say, look, it's not just the rabbi over there and somewhere living somewhere in Persia, but it's the queen of the whole world. We've got to follow this and we've got to do it. And Mordechai and Esther, in verse 29, essentially reaffirm the existence of the Purim holiday. There's only one problem. Problem is, you want to get it canonized. If it's ever going to become holy, it's ever going to become accepted, it's got to be in the Bible. And how do you get a book which is very nice and a lovely story with a happy ending and all the rest of it, how do you get it put into the canon, into the Bible? And that's where the men of the Great Assembly come in. And it's a principle, the Talmud says it, Nevuah from Chutz La'aretz. If a Nevuah, a prophecy takes place outside Israel, like Yechezkel, classic, where is Ezekiel's prophecies? Mainly in Babylon. The Valley of Dry Bones and all the rest of it. He's out of Israel. He's one of the exiles. So he's looking at these prophecies, and the rabbis say in the Gemara that I just quoted from Baba Batra, no, writing down those prophecies in Babylon is not good enough. They've got to be written by people who know what they're doing in Eretz Israel. In order to establish the Megillah, there is part three, which is not mentioned in the Megillah itself, but is mentioned in the Talmud. The men of the Great Assembly, Anshe Knesset HaGdolah, who lived after the Purim story, wrote it down, or rather reaffirmed, or whatever they did. Maybe they tweaked it, I don't know how they did it. Sent it out to all the communities, but it came from Israel. The post, you know, the stamp was now an Israeli stamp. Wasn't coming from Persia, it wasn't coming from a place which maybe they might say, well, it was a concoction or whatever. It's coming from Eretz Israel. And that's. I just want to add one point, I'll take your question. And not only that, but of course, what happens is the men of the Great Assembly established that things are written with Ruach HaKodesh. It's not now just a historical document anymore, but it's a book with spiritual content, with spiritual foundations. It's something which becomes so much more holy, and then, of course, it goes into the Bible. It's a very interesting development. Again, I didn't know this till I read about this quite recently. Yeah.
So, the Gemara that you referred to in Baba Batra said, Yechezkel, Daniel, Esther, anything else? Because all those were outside of everything.
Correct, and the Treyasar, even...
And the Treyasar was...
Had some word, had their prophecies in Israel. That's an interesting question. Because there they include the Treyasar. There were prophets in Israel, presumably somewhere outside Israel.
Uh-huh.
But they lumped it all together, I
so
guess.
So that makes sense to be, as a...
It
as
fits
a,
in generally with that theme. Yeah,
there
it really does.
And that's why they chose those in that Gemara.
Correct. And beautiful. It's fascinating that that's... That, so that's how the development of the Book of Esther comes about. Very interesting. Okay. Now, go back to the Book of Esther and look at that verse that we just spoke about, verse 29, and I'm going to go back to it again. And have a look at this, because this is where we get into our subject, which is all about Purim in the future. There is this very well-known statement, which is really mind-blowing, which basically says that all the holidays, when the Mashiach comes, please God, very soon. I was talking last week to my class at YU about what I call messianic moments in Jewish history. For those of us who are old enough to remember the Six-Day War, that to me, absolutely a messianic moment which never came about. Rav Goren wanted to, he went to Dayan and he said, Moshe Dayan, you've got to build the Beit HaMikdash. The Arabs are running away from Yerushalayim. This is it. This is our moment. And for whatever reason, Dayan said no. And the Israeli government, you know, they do make mistakes. We know that they're human like everybody else. And this was probably one of the biggest mistakes they ever made. And come back 50, 60 years later, and look, you can't even go near the Har HaBayit without people spitting on you. It's a terrible thing. Our holiest place. So it's a problem. So the reality of it is that, again, the concept was, I think, the idea of moments in history, special moments in history that we are talking about here, and the particularly we're talking here about the whole thing of Megillat Esther. Have a look at this special moment. Vatichtov Esther, again, verse 29. Vatichtov Esther Malka Bat Avicha Mordechai Yudit Kol HaTokif L'Kayem Et Geret HaPurim Hazot Sheinit, to keep this holiday that I sent it out for the second time. If you just go back to verse 28, Ayomim ha'ele niskarim v'nasim chodo v'do, these are the days I mention every generation. Mishpacha, mishpacha, medina, medina, it's a family gathering as well as a communal gathering. Ir v'ir, yumeipurim ha'ele lo ya'avru mitoch ha'yudim, these days will not part, go away from the Jews. V'zichrom lo yosuf mizaram, and their memory will not disappear or go away from the seed, from the future generations. The quote from, it's a midrash in, where is it? It's midrash Mishle. Very, very amazing statement. And the rabbis say, Igeret HaPurim, just a second, I've got it here. Yeah, it says Zichram lo yasuv, the memory will not go away. It's actually Jerusalem Talmud in Megillah, but I think it's also in Mishle, in Midrash Mishle. Yeah, the Torah Tumimah brings it. Torah Tumimah, I'm not going to explain. I'm not going to go into the what exactly that sefer is, but he always brings these quotes. Listen to this. This is the famous quote. Melameh. What does it mean that Purim will never go away? Melameh, the teachers, Shafilu Kol Amoadim Yiyu B'Teilim. Even if all the holidays will go away, no Pesach, that's an interesting thought. Aval Yemei HaPurim Lo Yibatlu. Purim will never be done away with. Purim will never be cancelled. It's almost suggesting, and in fact there's a different version in the Jerusalem Talmud, which puts it slightly differently, Melameh Shemegillat Esther Lo Olam Lo Tibatel, that the Megillah will never be done away with, it'll never be cancelled. Alright? They gave a tremendous force to Megillat Esther and to the holiday of Purim. And the question is, what does this mean? Are we learning here from these various statements of the rabbis that, in fact, Purim is never going to go away? Meaning, being Talmudic, if it says that's not a go away, but all the others will, and are we talking about a world after Mashiach comes when there's no Pesach, no Shavuos, right? You know, it makes it easy for work, for sure. And all these things, is it really what's going to happen? And is that what the Gemara means? Is that what the rabbis were meaning by saying, according to what the verse says, Lo Yavru means Purim will never go away, all the other holidays will go away. Is that what it means? And this is, again, on the basis now that we've established that this is a book based in Ruach HaKodesh, so it has this spiritual dimension from the men of the Great Assembly. What was meant by this phrase, which the rabbis go on to explain, Purim is a permanent fixture. Have a look at the page in front of you, and this is really interesting. You have at the beginning, I've done it in sort of like A, B, and C. You've got section A, all in Hebrew, and I'm going to read a little bit of this. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. If you just turn over, you'll see there's also section B from the Torah Tumimah, which I just mentioned, and section C from Rabbanit Shira Smile. Shira Smile is a wonderful teacher in Los Angeles. And this whole article, which I hope you'll take away, which goes on for 3 pages, I produced the whole thing, is her collection of various rabbis, mainly contemporary, many of whom I've met, some of whom I think have even been here as well, who talk about the Purim holiday in this context of the holiday never being cancelled. But what does that mean? But I'm going to go back to A, and I'll talk a little bit about Rav Sternbuch. Sternbuch at the moment is the head of the Badatz. So when you go to Israel and you get that Hechsher, which is on a lot of things now, Badatz, right? Except for Pesach, when they take the Hekshem away from everything. My favorite Badatz story, I have to just add it, is that the Badatz are very good at giving Hekshem, but not very good at dealing with the modern world. So in 1996, there was a wonderful story that went around that a yogurt, which was given a Hekshem from the Badatz, just to give you a little idea of sometimes the mistakes that these people can make, they gave the Hekshem, and all of a sudden the Hekshem went away. And everyone was very confused. At the time, it was a Tanuva that were making the yogurt, or Tena, one of these companies. And the problem was like this, that because at that time, 1996, as many of you will remember, if your kids were glued to TV, at that time, what was the big show at that time? Barney the Dinosaur. Go figure. So what was the logo of Tena? Barney the Dinosaur. So along come the, you can imagine, you know what the bats are like, right? So they were told, you gave a Heksha to dinosaurs. Right? This is what they were told. Barney the dinosaur. Pete, a purple, they believed there was a purple dinosaur. Maybe they did. So they took the Heksher away. Unbelievable. Not because the item was not kosher, but because there was a logo, Barney the dinosaur. I mean, it's hysterical.
Or there was a dinosaur.
It's so scary. This is sometimes the logic that you have to put up with. Putting that to one side, because I think maybe 25 years later, somebody explained to them that Barney the dinosaur is not for real, and I think that was you said Yiddish a gelechter, they really made a joke of themselves. They're now under the auspices of somebody called Moshe Sturmel. Now, Moshe Sturmel is interesting. He went to school with my father-in-law. It's very interesting. He was born and bred in London. And for many years, he was a rabbi in South Africa. He was in Johannesburg. And apart from anything else, what is very incongruous there, when you go in and you want to speak to a Sturmel, talk to him in English, which is very rare. Head of a Badatz, normally you'll not be able to talk to him, mostly in Yiddish or Ivrit, but very rarely can have a conversation in English, and he's fluent in English. In fact, you know, he would have done the Barney the Dinosaur thing, he would have called everybody crazy. But, you know, he knows what he's dealing with there. And he's a very interesting character, very, very idiosyncratic, very unusual. And he's written a whole series of books called Tshuvot v'Hanhagot, right? Responsa and the way, Minhag, Hanhagot from the word Minhag, the way to conduct yourself. And in one of these responsa over here, he writes about this whole statement of the rabbis, what's going to be with Purim in the future? Does it mean, as I said here, you see, She'ela Purim Latid Lavo, what is Purim going to be like in the future? And he doesn't quote the statement that I quoted to you from the Midrash, but he quotes the Rambam, because the Rambam actually codifies this. It's very interesting. Look at the page in front of you, and it's the second line in Hebrew. Rabbi M. Shtobuch, head of the Badatz in Jerusalem, Shabbi Kazun, he's really a special man. And he says like this, Katava Rambam, I'm just going to read it to you. So Perik Bet de Megillah, the Rambam at the end of the laws of Megillah writes, He kayemet kachamisha chumshe Torah, when it says Purim will be forever, it's going to be like the five books of Moses. It's going to have the same status. Ukilchot shel Torah shebal peh, and like the laws of Torah shebal peh, the oral law, she'inam b'teilim l'olam, those laws will go on forever. The af al pi, and he explains, and this is Rambam's take, she'kol zikaron atzarot, what does it mean Purim will be there and all the other holidays won't? He says what it means is that with the Messianic period, all of the troubles that we had, represented by, for instance, the holiday of Pesach, and essentially Sukkot be going out into the desert, being in difficult circumstances, and overcoming those circumstances, he said all of that memory will go away. Why? Because he says, Kol Sifrei Nevi'im, V'chol HaKetuvim Atidim Litbatel, Imat HaMashiach. All of those books which are referring to our history and all of those events in Jewish history which we went through, all those difficult times, all the judges and everything else that come along, and the kings, he said, all of that will libatel, will be annulled. Chutz mimegilat Esther, except the book of Esther. In other words, according to the Rambam, it's not talking about the holiday, it's talking about the book. The book of Esther will always be around. The holiday of Purim will always be around as well. But it doesn't mean that the other holidays will disappear, but it means that all of the reasons that we have for the other books of the Bible, and therefore for the holidays as well, all of that will be forgotten. Some sort of strange concept like this, very strange. And he says, Shenemar, because it says, Ki nishkecha atzarot arishonot, all of the early troubles will be forgotten, V'chi nisru me'inai, and they will be hidden. Yemei ha-purim lo yibatlu, that the days of Purim, they will always be remembered, they will never go away. Shenema v'yemei purim ha'ele lo yavar, as we read in the Megillah. Mitoch ha-yudim zichrom le'yosuf mizaram. And his suggestion is that, I think, the Rambam is saying, seemingly, is that the Bible is going to become, what's the word? It's going to go onto the bookshelf and it's going to be forgotten. The books of the Bible that we need for all the lessons and all the moral teachings and everything else will become, basically, what's the word? Irrelevant. Not the five books of Moshe, but the rest of the books. Yeah.
What I understand is that the book of Esther is the only one that doesn't mention Hashem.
And that's
so how, if everything else, then here what...
And that's a great question. And that the answer to that goes back to what we said before. Because it was written originally in Chutz La'aretz. Right. And they didn't write down the name of God in books in Chutz La'aretz. That's the one of the explanations. When it got to Eretz Yisrael and they rewrote it, they couldn't change the basic format. But they said every melech refers to the king and the king of kings. So if you have a Megillah at home, a scroll, look at the scroll. Some of them have, every column begins with the word Melech. Very clever how the sofa does it. Don't know how he does it, but he does it. They do it, and they have what is called Megillat HaMelech, which is really a tradition, that the word Melech, because Melech means God, as well as the King Ahasuerus. So there is a reference, but not direct. But you're right, it's a big irony here, that the book that's going to survive is the one without God's name. Go figure. But this is going to be a clue to what we're going to say now.
But how can you have any of the holidays without context? I mean, how can you have Pesach or Sukkot or Shavuot without context?
Yeah, the answer is the five books of Moses, he says, will survive, and therefore presumably the holidays will have that sense of connection because of those books. But are the holidays really going to be there or not? It's not clear. I will argue it's not clear. And it could be, you could understand, the rabbinic tradition is that Purim is going to be there, and the other holidays, you know what? Maybe not so much. And that's a very shocking but very interesting thought. The messianic days are going to be so full of miracles and so full of events that we won't need to think about going out of Egypt, sitting and eating our matzah, because we'll have Yemot Mashiach, there'll be a holiday, maybe Tisha B'Av will become this great holiday once a year, and that will supersede everything. Which is a very interesting suggestion. Not everybody agrees to it, as you can see, there's an argument here. And I would argue Rambam is not so clear in that context of the holidays, only in terms of the books. The Rambam says when the Gemara says Purim will survive and all the other holidays won't, or meaning not the holidays, but the books which are containing the sorrows, the troubles, etc., all of those will be cancelled, they will go away. The book of Shmuel, in other words, our Haftarah, sure will get a bit shorter. We'll only be reading the five books, we won't have the Haftarahs. You know, it may save a few minutes if that's the way to explain it. It's strange.
Another reason to pray for Mashiach.
Believe me, getting somebody to do the Haftarah could be very challenging. If you're doing the one 2 weeks ago, which goes on for like 10 pages, it's really a problem.
It's based only on that pasuk within...
The Megillah. And again, I wanted to give the intro of the validity of these psukim, because that's very interesting. At least I can understand now why the rabbis are having this debate, because... if this is just a historical document, then you can say this was the whim of Esther and Mordechai, that Purim should be permanent forever and ever. And good luck to them, right? You know, they want it to be established. Once you get you say in Yiddish, the Gushbanka, you know, the stamp, the stempel of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the bearded gentleman, then you know it's serious comment. And you have to take it seriously, right? Meaning, it's going to be around forever, but what are they actually saying? I'll show you a little bit what Rav Sternberg says, because he says that he tries to explain the Rambam. And I'm just going to sort of talk around a little bit of this, but again, not go through the whole thing. La'niyo dati, this is under the dotted line. Direi Rambam kshuto. The Rambam is, he says, obvious. I'm glad he thinks it's obvious, because I'm not sure exactly whether that's the case, but he says the hinei. It's the first page, and it's under the broken line. He says, really, all of the message of the books of prophets are really in the Torah. And he brings various statements of the Gemara. Go down to the third line. We couldn't find these messages in the Torah. We weren't, as it were, enlightened enough. Al-Kain, Nikla, Binaviyim, Baruchah, so the books of prophets were written, Kedei lahasbir ladgish advarim, to explain those lessons. Lessons of honesty and truth, etc., etc. Aval kashi avo Mashiach, the end of the third line, tzikenu, when the Mashiach comes, nireh hakol b'tara kedosha gufa, lo nitztarech ninevim. So he says not that the holidays will be cancelled, but the books won't just, we just won't need the Bible the way it is. Av shelo yitbatel chas v'shalom. We're not saying the holidays are cancelled, the books are going to completely be discarded. No, he says we just won't need them anymore. Masha'en came Megillat Esther, the end of the fourth line. Shekula Yeshua. This is the point. He says Esther represents a salvation. B'derech hateva. Now this is the real focus of what we're saying here. Why is Purim so special? Because everything about Purim is to do with nature. We know and we understand, and this is, you know, you've heard this probably many, many times. What is so unique about the Purim holiday is that it was a natural event. There's no, as we said, no mention of God. So if there's no mention of God in the holiday, in the book, therefore the idea is God is behind the scenes. The hand of Hashem conducts everything, but it's all about understanding the process. The process of the world that we live in is not the big hand coming down from heaven pointing at you to tell you to do this or not to do that. There's no thunder and lightning. There's no 10 plagues anymore. What we have is we have the natural order. And within the natural order, he says, that becomes significant, that Purim is the holiday we focus on, because that shows that within the natural order, God is still present. And this is something which is one of the real lessons of the book of the Megillah. And he goes on and on and on. You can see there's a whole page over here, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but he says that's why there's going to be a mitzvah to continue reading the story of the Megillah, and it will gain the status. He says that according to this, it will have the status of Kriyat HaTorah, the way we read the five books of Moses. Now we know that it has a lower status. The Torah scroll you don't touch, the Megillah, we handle it. It doesn't have the same status. It's on a scroll, but not as holy as the Torah scroll. He says what will happen when Mashiach comes is that the Megillah will become elevated. It will become like a full Torah scroll. But what is clear is that nobody is prepared to say that the actual holidays represented by the three holidays that we know are going to be cancelled and Purim is going to stay. Nobody says that here. All they're saying is that either the books which represent the troubles that we experienced in Jewish history and for so many years, those books are going to go away, but Purim will always be around because the book of Purim will always be around. It's a comment about the books, but not about the holidays. Yeah?
It almost seems like we need it to be more elevated now because we live in where God is hidden, right? And we need to understand God's hand everywhere. In the time of Mashiach,
correct.
You know, what is obscure will become more obvious, right?
Yeah.
It says all the people in the world will see God and
excellent.
Understand God.
Excellent.
So it's almost as if a strange thing to say, that's when we elevate
That's when we elevate it. And the answer is, I suppose, in order to remind us that, and this is what I'm going to say at the end, that the greatest, and I really believe this, the greatest miracle, and this is, if you look at the page, the last page, D, it's written by Jacob Emden. Jacob Emden was the rabbi, famous rabbi at the time of Shabtai Tzvi. You know, there were two rabbis who got really at each other's throats because of the Shabtai Tzvi thing. One was Jacob Emden, the other one was Jonathan Abershitz, and they were both great, great rabbis, but got very embroiled in the story. And Jacob Emden writes in his Sidur, the introduction, the miracle of Jewish survival, I'm just paraphrasing, but it's a long, long piece. The miracle of Jewish survival is greater than all miracles recorded in our history. That, he says, is the theme of Jewish survival, but of course that's what we're talking about with Purim. That why we will need this in Messianic times is to remember that not everything that we went through in the sense that we need to remember it all, but that we are still here to tell the story. I always talk about, you know, the fact that we're sitting in a room here, either here in Cherry Hill, or I talk to the students in Manhattan, I said, look, we're all sitting around and we're learning about something and we really should be a footnote in history. The reality is that everyone we learn about, the Babylonians and the Greeks and you name it, everybody, the Romans, they're all footnotes in a library somewhere. And here we are vibrant, learning about all of this stuff, learning about, we're keeping them alive. It's not that they oppressed us. We are now doing them a favor. We're keeping their memory alive, because we always talk about the Romans and the Crusades and all the rest of all of this stuff, which has been history for that thousand, maybe a couple of thousand years. So that's what we'll need to have at Messianic time, that awareness of the fact that we are still around remembering the story. And that's an incredible thing. And in a sense, if you go back to the second page, the side section B, which is the Torah Tumim's own explanation, I quoted from this commentary on the Book of Esther. He actually quotes his father, very rare. His father was a famous halachist called the Oruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Mechel Epstein. Right? Whether he's related to Rabbi Epstein here, I don't know. I never asked him. He may be connected. I don't know. They are related. Oh, that's interesting. All right. So the Rabbi Chil Mechel, the famous father, who was really the greatest halachist probably in Lithuania, beginning of the 20th century, that's a whole shiv for another time. Very interesting rabbi. He says that, again, what is the whole lesson of Purim, and why is it always going to be around? And you see that three lines from the end of that paragraph B, the word hateva. But often shemish libo chalag me'emunat Hashem, even someone who is divorced from faith, can explain everything in a natural way, but nevertheless, Purim is going to be there because it's there to teach a person nature is just really another form of God's eminence, God's appearance in the world. But it comes to us as nature, and therefore we don't appreciate it. Rabbi Dessler says very clearly why. Rabbi Dessler, the very famous Mashgiach of Ponovich, he said, because we see it every day. Why don't we get so excited when a sunrise happens? We do. Once, maybe in a lifetime, when we go up to the top of Masada, if you've ever done it, you see the sunrise, it's the most magnificent thing you've ever seen. And then you ask yourself, why don't we get excited about this every day? And the answer is, that's the answer, because it's every day. And because it happens every day, we become used to it. We don't get overawed by nature. But nature is an incredible thing. And therefore, again, all the rabbis, and here we're talking about mainstream, of Sternbuch Badatz, Rav Epstein, who really came from that very strong Lithuanian world, all really trying to say the same thing. The message is not that the holidays will be cancelled per se, but that the message of Purim will never be cancelled. The message of Purim is that we're dealing with a miracle within nature. And what I wanted to show you, and this to me is really the greatness of Torah. I don't know about you guys, but I'm kind of distressed. The compartmentalizing of the Jewish world today is really very distressing. If you don't wear the right clothes, you don't look the right part, you're pushed out to, you know, you're not kosher Jew for some, you're too kosher for others. We've made these barriers, we've made these divisions, and it's very distressing. And what I like to show here, just a little bit with this, you know, you could be anything. I mean, Jews are Jew, really, the bottom line, but we keep forgetting that. And what Rabbanit Smiles talks about here is that she brings some all different sources, modern sources, right across the spectrum. She starts off with David Cohen Shlita, one of the great, real interesting voices in Brooklyn today. And he also, if you read paragraph A, he talks about the idea presented there serves a perfect springboard. He writes that all the other holidays find their roots in the supernatural miracles of the Exodus of Egypt. However, all those miracles will pale in comparison to the miracles God will perform, the coming of Mashiach. The Purim redemption, in contrast, took place through non-miraculous, naturally unfolding events. The same idea. The idea is that we're celebrating with Purim something unique. That it was a celebration, is a celebration of events coming at us from a non-miraculous source, but through nature. And that's Reb David Cohen, very much, I would say again, to the right of the spectrum. Go on to the next page. Sorry, you look at, just to give you a bit of a range over here, paragraph D, and you'll see she quotes from Rabbi Rivlin. Rivlin is a teacher at Keren B'Yavne, which again is very much more mainstream, sort of the flagship of the Yeshivot Datiot and the Yeshivat Datit and all the rest of it, the mainstream, originally sort of we would say more from the sort of the Mizrahi perspective.
Yeah, I was going to say that it's the war against anti-Semitism. That's going to be, and
we'll come to that as a final comment. But he quotes it from Rabbi Rivlin, who says the idea of Machad in the Hesterion but Esther, there is a concept, why is Esther so significant, the book, because it talks about tomorrow. All the time, things are happening tomorrow. Remember the two meals in the middle. She says, come today and then come back tomorrow. Why is there a tomorrow? Because with Amalek, the whole pattern was established. They didn't fight Amalek immediately. They had to wait 24 hours. It was all about tomorrow. Amalek represents belief not in tomorrow, but in today. We establish a belief in tomorrow. This is a beautiful idea. He says the Jewish concept is that we believe in a tomorrow. He says the person without emunah, without faith, can be very much a person who believes in the here and now, but when you talk about tomorrow, the world to come, and all these concepts, they just can't handle that and they don't believe it. And the holiday of Purim, he says Rabbi Rivlin, again, a similar concept has within it a significance which is important for our faith, for our future, the way we look at the world as Jews. And he says this beautiful thing there is here, and again, as I said, you can take this away and read this, because it's so readable. Section B, which is quoted here, forgotten now who she quotes, Rabbi Tatz. Rabbi Tatz is, again, a wonderful teacher, lives in London, who's involved, again, more mainstream, I would say. Don't know if he's actually been here, but I know he does come to America from time to time. He says, why is Purim so significant? Because, as you rightly said, the battle against anti-Semitism never goes away, right? And we're looking at it now, and there was a big ad I just noticed in the Jewish press. This is not an advert to read the Jewish press, I have to add, but you know, I get it as a freebie, so every so often, so I look at it. Got to add that little rider. And there's literally a full-page advert. There is no place for anti-Semitism in New York today. Big page put in by the New York City, whatever, signed by de Blasio and all the rest of it. That I've never seen an ad like that, and certainly not in the Jewish press. And that is significant in terms of the times that we are living in at present, and it never goes away. So if you read this, he brings very nice, beautiful connection to the events. Haman min haTorah, the Gemara says, where do we see Haman? In the Torah. And the Gemara says, from the Garden of Eden. Go figure. So you've got here a whole explanation here how Haman is connected to the Garden of Eden. I don't want to go through all this because it's there for you to take away and to enjoy. It's a beautiful article. But what I want to say is really right at the end. Because really to sum up, what we've done today is looked at the veracity, the truth of the holiday in the sense that it's imbued by Ruach HaKodesh, meaning rabbis who gave it this imprint, right, of holiness. So it's there established. We're now saying, why has it got such a lot of traction? Because it represents so many themes which are going to carry with us even after the Messianic days, things dealing with the presence of God in nature and all these kind of things. Does it mean the other holidays will be canceled? We're saying no. According to the Rambam, it means that the books that are represented by the other holidays, meaning the wider literature that we've had for all these years, that may become less important, let's put it that way, but the Book of Purim will never stop being important. I'm going to suggest one final thought, because I really believe this might be the key to this statement of the rabbis, and if I get shot down over this, I don't care, because I think it's one of those things that's always been in the back of my mind. The final thought, Purim is the quintessential Back to the Future holiday, that's what we're saying. From Purim that we learn in the past, take us right through to the future, will never disappear, and I didn't add this, but I'm adding it now, it's a statement of rabbinic legitimacy. In the end of the day, when the rabbis came along and made their holidays, and the holiday of Purim is quintessential, it's like the most fundamental Jewish holiday of rabbinic status, they wanted to establish their legitimacy forever and ever. And I understand that. In a way, it's part of what was going on at this time of the Second Temple, the whole fight between the Sadducees who said Torah Baal Peh is not to be accepted, they rejected the oral law, only the written law was to be observed, and many of the Kohanim were Sadducees. Very interesting development over there, because most of their lives revolved around the written Torah, the laws of the temple, which are all spelled out in the Torah. But anything which is of rabbinic origin, what we call the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, the Sadducees didn't want to know. And it became a problem later on in history with the Karaites. They also did away with it. So I think Purim, being the quintessential, being the most rabbinic holiday that exists in our calendar, that, the rabbis say, will never go away. Because that establishes the authority, the ability of the rabbis to create a holiday which is everlasting, which by definition becomes Torah. Because Torah Shebaal Peh for us, we just read the whole Mamad HaSinai, we read it again yesterday in Parashat Mishpatim, it's an event which for us is so basic, so essential in our, in who we are as Jews. Not only that we got a written Torah, but that we got the oral Torah as well. And therefore I would argue as a statement of rabbinic legitimacy, strength, whatever word you want to use, Purim becomes that holiday that will never disappear. Reality is, you know, as you rightly said, the Mashiach time, that was your question, do we really need a Purim? And the answer is yes, for all different reasons. Either, as we've said, because of the lessons of Purim, or I would argue of the essential existence of a rabbinic holiday, which by definition... Rabbis will never go away. This is the depressing conclusion of the... of the.
We have rabbis in Mashiach time.
I know, and this is kind of scary. I will...
Baruch Hashem.
This is not...
legitimacy. I mean, isn't that sort of frozen in time? Because now we don't have that feeling that there is no Beit Knesset HaGdolah that everybody adheres to.
Yeah.
And now it's just fraction.
That's one of the messianic dreams, is that there'll be a Sanhedrin and people will come along and everybody will accept the authority of the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. Not if they're Jews. Now, not only that, but I have to tell you this because it's interesting. This is interesting because I heard a talk from I don't know if he's still alive, somebody called Fred Rosner. He's the father of Shalom Rosner, if you follow Rabbi Rosner online. He's very good. His father's a doctor, very famous doctor, lived in Long Island. And he gave a talk in London, and he said that he asked from Moshe Feinstein once, he said, when the Sanhedrin comes, and we all believe in that one source, as you rightly said, maybe, you know, Mashiach, right? Mashiach Tzai, as my grandmother once said. Yeah. The reality is that what's the first thing the Sanhedrin is going to do? What Feinstein said, and this might shock you, he said that every Jew is going to carry a donor card. That they have to have a donor card which says that they are prepared to donate organs for other Jews.
Wow.
No, for other people. It doesn't say other Jews.
For other Jews, yeah.
No, it doesn't say other... When Israel, he's talking about in Israel initially. Okay. For Jews, but I think this might go even further, to save life. Because he said that has to be... Because he was taken up with so many questions about transplants, because that's when it all started, when Feinstein in the 70s, and he was going strong. And that was a big shock to me. But what it suggested is that the Sanhedrin is going to come and be pretty radical. And the most radical concept, as you rightly point out, is that everyone's going to accept it. Hasidim, Misnagdim, Tzfadim, Ashkenazim, you name it. The only question I still have with Mashiach, the definition, is what Nusa is going to daven in the Beit HaMikdash. There's going to have to be Binyanim. There's no way. How are we all going to go and daven under 1 minyan? I mean, yeah, maybe Ne'ilah, they'll all come together from Ne'ilah, like some shuls do.
It'll just be different minyanim, it'll just be in the Beit HaMikdash.
And it'll all be in the Beit HaMikdash. So it's going to be the shul of all shuls. Imagine being, I don't say this to you, imagine being the president of that shul. Please go, we'll have a president, we'll have the whole thing. I leave this with you because, as I said, there are some beautiful ideas. He's got a bit Hasidic in the middle, so please read the Hasidic stuff. I didn't want to bring it verbatim. I can't do it justice. There's a lot to say here. The bottom line of it is, seems to be that you're still stuck with Pesach, I'm sorry to say. Happy to say, maybe. But certainly in terms of prioritization, when it comes to a different concept in the world, a different awareness of God in the world, then Purim takes pride and joy. It's head and shoulders above all the other holidays. And I think that was worth coming out to hear. Two things. Number one, the origin of the holiday. And number two, this beautiful idea of the lessons of Purim. May we all enjoy it. May we all imbibe the lessons, not necessarily imbibe anything else. And please God, it should be really a messianic holiday for us as well.
Oh,
please God, very soon.
Amen.
Thank you. What's the elephant in the room?
The Esther and
Yeah. Oh man. All I can say is I'm going to talk about it. It'll be online, so you can listen to the shiur. And then, 2 weeks time, there is a chapter in the book of Nehemiah that you have to read, which talks about the relationship between Esther and Achashverosh and the reasons why Esther, particularly the Gemara says Esther was married to Mordechai. So go figure, a nice married Jewish woman stays with Achashverosh. Is really And the Gemara's even got suggestions about that she was going one night to Achashverosh, going back to Mordechai.
Oh.
Don't ask. I'm not even. Don't even want to say.
It's in
Talmud. I mean, this is Talmud, and it's there. So we need to know this.
You're but the bottom line. A week from Wednesday, you're giving that to you.
It's about not this week, but probably a week on Wednesday. And it's an interesting thing.
What's the URL for that?
It's yutara.org. And it's there. There's a whole series. I mean, I've done about 13 or 14 shurim so far on Gilad Esther. So it's just interesting to read, to listen to. And there will be what to say. And that chapter, I think, is chapter 2 of the book of Nehemiah, kind of answers the whole thing. Believe it or not, when I just want to say one thing, that when the Jews got back to Eretz Israel and they built the second temple, they made a holiday, the 16th of Adar. Very interesting. So they had the 14th and 15th Purim. And the 16th in Yerushalayim, as a celebration of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, and it became a big celebration where they also gave gifts. They did Matanot Levionim, they gave Mishloach Mat. Very, very fascinating. So there's what to say, the continuation of Esther and Achashverosh. They have a son called Darius. Darius gives permission for the Jews to rebuild the second temple. So you know what? God has a plan in history. It doesn't always conform to the most kosher of attitudes that we may want to apply to it. In the end of the day, that's what happened. But it's very interesting reading. But
what about just the? What about you going back to not miraculous and just what happened? Maybe she wasn't allowed to leave. Do you ever think about that?
He was
the king.
Yeah.
Can you imagine her saying, "Okay, we got our Jews taken care of. Goodbye, dear."
Yeah, she couldn't do that.
I agree with you.
But you
now to say I'm out of here.
Yeah,
I don't know
it's not going to be so easy.
But just her plan to seduce.
But the scandal of it, it's a massive issue. And Talmud tries to deal with it because it is a big problem. I wish everybody a very happy and Freilich and Purim. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much.